You're listening to Admitting Diagnosis, the Journal Watch podcast for the week ending June 20th. I'm Joe Elia. We offer a roundup of the week's news along with an interview we hope you'll find of interest. This week's interview is about the discordance between patients' expectations for survival and what the disease models predict. If you'd like to leave us a comment, and we hope that you will, call 617-440-4374. That's 617-440-4374. Story links are available at podcasts.jwatch.org. Okay, here's the week's medical news in brief. We've got five top stories ranging from the dangers of not adhering to epileptic medication to the unconventional dangers of conventional antipsychotic drugs to what happens when inhalers go green, a reminder to remain vigilant when inducing labor, and finally, the victory of rate over rhythm, at least in matters cardiological. Non-adherence to anti-epileptic drugs can do you in, according to a study in neurology. A study of Medicaid data from three states showed that mortality risk was three times higher during periods of non-adherence. Non-adherence meant more visits to the ER, more hospitalizations, more car crashes, and more fractures. A maker of the drugs sponsored the study. Next, conventional antipsychotic drugs don't carry conventional risks, especially in the elderly. They too have earned an FDA boxed warning, similar to the 2005 warning issued for atypical antipsychotics. The warning stems from a Canadian study that Journal Watch General Medicine covered back in March. The authors of that study warned that all antipsychotic drugs should be considered risky in elderly patients. Inhalers will go green at the end of the year. Many now carry ozone-depleting chlorofluorocarbon propellants, and to eliminate that threat to the environment, the inhalers will contain hydrofluoroalkanes. Remember those guys from Organic Chem Days? Journal Watch Pediatrics and Adolescent Medicine has a helpful feature by Howard Bochner on the new inhalers, with links to FDA resources on how to use them. Induced labor requires more vigilance, an article in the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology warns. Looking at records of about 50 healthy women admitted for elective labor induction, researchers found hyperstimulation in 41 of the 50 women, leading to progressive oxygen desaturation in the fetus. Writing in Journal Watch Women's Health, Diane Angelini says that the results, quoting, support the conclusion that fetal oxygen desaturation begins within the first 5 minutes of excessive uterine activity and has already progressed before any non-reassuring changes in fetal heart rate occur. She concludes, quoting again, clearly, oxytocin use requires closer surveillance and more attention from obstetricians, midwives, and nurses. Finally, rate bests rhythm in heart failure, according to two studies in the New England Journal of Medicine, or at least rhythm control held no advantage over rate control in one international randomized trial of over 1,300 patients. Another study was stopped early because of a higher mortality risk in patients on a new Class 3 antiarrhythmic. In Journal Watch Cardiology, Mark Link comments, quoting, sinus rhythm control cannot be recommended for reduction of mortality in patients with or without heart failure. Sinus rhythm control may be a reasonable strategy to treat specific patient complaints that arise directly from atrial fibrillation. A reminder, story links are available at podcasts.jwatch.org. Here is the Journal Watch interview for this week. JAMA published a paper earlier this month from Duke. It was about patients' estimates of their own life expectancy. The patients, about 120 of them, and all ambulatory, had heart failure, and about half were in New York Heart Association Class 3 or 4. When the researchers asked the patients via questionnaire to estimate how long they would live, the patients gave a median estimate of 13 years. But the Seattle Heart Failure Model, a standard means of calculating survival in the disease, predicted a median of only 10 years. In fact, the patients' estimates of their longevity more closely matched actuarial life tables based only on age and sex, without regard to disease status. We've asked Dr. Larry Allen to talk with us about all this. Dr. Allen was first author on the JAMA paper, and he's a clinical instructor in cardiology at Duke. Welcome, Larry.
Thank you for having me.
Is there something unique about heart failure, or is this discordance between expectations and models often seen when patients estimate their own survival?
Well, I think there are two answers to that question. First off, I think in general patients probably do overestimate life expectancy regardless of the disease state they have. There has been similar research to this done in the oncology field, and there patients have also tended to overestimate their life expectancy. However, I think that heart failure patients are somewhat unique. What some study previously had shown that cancer patients, when asked about their disease and dying, thought of dying as being directly due to the disease process. However, our findings from this study seem to indicate that heart failure patients tend to view heart failure as a disease that they have, but is really a process more of aging. And consequently, the estimations that patients gave seem to be relatively independent of their severity of heart failure and rather more dependent just on their own chronological age. So there may be some differences, even though the overall trend is similar.
It seemed that the sicker the patients were, the more likely they were to overestimate their own survival. Now, that measure of illness was done with, for instance, ejection fractions and New York Heart Association class, things that patients don't talk about amongst themselves. Even though they must have felt bad to be in New York in classes 3 and 4, they still had this kind of hope, didn't they?
Yeah, that's right. I think that's one of the key findings from the study that we published, which is that patients tended to estimate their life expectancy exactly the same on average, regardless of their symptoms or functional class. So whether patients were New York Heart Association class 1, 2, 3, or 4, the average estimation for those patients of their patient-predicted life expectancy was exactly the same. However, if you look at model predictions on life expectancy are heavily driven by patients' functional class. And consequently, when we performed looked at the ratio of how long patients thought they would live versus what the model thought they would live, the more sick patients were in terms of their functional class, obviously the more they overestimated their life expectancy, or they ended up having what we considered to be an optimistic outlook for their prognosis.
Let's talk about those ratios for a moment. Let's pretend that I'm Joe, the patient, and you ask me, and I'm in New York Heart Association class 4, and you ask me, well, Joe, what do you estimate how long you will live? And I say, well, I'm going to live for 20 years. And the Seattle measure says, well, Joe's only going to live for 10. So that would so you derive the ratio just by putting my estimate over the Seattle estimate. And in my case, it would be 2. Isn't that right?
That's right.
Okay. And so you didn't have too many people who were that high up, though. They were, although I did see some that were out, they were probably outliers. They were wildly overestimating how long they would live.
Yeah. The median ratio of the patient versus the model was 1.4. But because of outliers, the mean was actually around 2.0.
Okay.
So, some of those outliers, particularly younger patients, said they would live as long as 40 or 50 years, whereas if they had advanced heart failure symptoms, the model said they might live 5 to 10. So, there was some skew in those results.
So the median is probably the more accurate number to look at here?
That's right. I think, like you said, outliers can really change the mean quite a bit. And I think when we're thinking of a population of patients, we want to kind of think in general about who the majority of those people are. So that's why in the paper we reported the median or an overestimation of 40%, which is that ratio.
That is a lot. That's a big overestimate on their part. Although the patients are not insurance adjusters or anything, and but they were guessing, as you say, based mostly on their age and sex, and not on their clinical condition.
Yeah, on average, that's what we found. We also asked the same kind of question, but in a different way on our questionnaire. We just asked patients what the outcome of their heart failure would be, and they had various options. And what I found also very surprising, in addition to the 40% overestimate, is that over half of the patients, about 52%, either answered that they would live a normal lifespan or that they would be cured from their heart failure. And I think those of us who take care of patients that have heart failure in a disease management clinic know that that's not the natural course of disease. So not only did we find a quantitative overestimation in life expectancy, we combined that with documenting kind of, I think, a misperception among patients about what the natural evolution of their disease is. And those two things together, I think, help support the general finding that patients really don't have a great grasp of how heart failure is going to affect their prognosis.
When you look at I think it's your figure five in the paper, and you look at people in early stage heart failure, stage one, people, I guess you could say, have just received a diagnosis. They're just becoming aware of the fact that they have this disease. You see that they tend to underestimate their survival. And the sicker they become, the more they tend to overestimate their survival. And I'm wondering if that early reaction to getting a diagnosis of heart failure is something that is sort of hangs crepe for them.
I do think, earlier we talked about the fact that on average patients didn't really factor in the severity of their heart failure. But I do think that there's some factoring of that, and consequently that might be the reason that patients who have a diagnosis of heart failure but really have no symptoms, and consequently whose model prediction for life expectancy wouldn't be that decreased by their diagnosis, they may actually overestimate. So there's not a complete a disregard for a diagnosis of heart failure patients. I think it's just that overall there's not a good understanding of how heart failure affects prognosis. In general, it's mostly disregarded, and I think in general patients don't recognize that a lot of it's driven not by the diagnosis but more so by the severity of the disease itself.
Do you think you may have glimpsed into something profound here, though? That what you're really measuring is the interaction that a patient is having with the medical system, where what they're saying at first is, well, I'm in good hands, I'm going to be cured, and then as their disease progresses, perhaps, as they have more of an experience of the disease, they're relying more and more on hope.
Yeah, I do think that hope may play a big role in this. One of the other investigators at the Duke Clinical Research Institute has looked into the concept of hope in oncology patients that are in phase one trials. And what he found in those patients is that if they were asked what their chance of benefiting from a phase one clinical trial was, they would say around 80%, when in truth it's probably more like 5%. But if they were asked, given a scenario where there was a third party or a different patient, and they said, what's the chance that this patient will benefit from the trial, they answered something like 20%. So given this same information, patients tend to estimate life expectancy or prognosis or chances of improving based more so on whether it's themselves they're talking about or somebody else. And that would indicate that it's not so much that they can't understand the facts or perceive what patients' prognosis are. It's that some of the overestimation may really be due to what I think we would call hope. And I think we probably see that with our patients. And so in going forward, I think one of the hardest questions we ask ourselves after doing this study is, sure, patients overestimate their life expectancy. They don't have a great perception in what heart failure means to them, at least in how they express it. But, you know, if that's hope, does that mean that we should do our best to remove that misperception? And I think we don't know the answer to that yet. Yeah. I've been kind of telling people that our goal is from the study was really just to characterize and quantify what that overestimation is. In terms of how I would use that in my clinical practice, I would say that, you know, our goal is not to take people's hope away. We want people to hope for the best, yet at the same time, I think in terms of planning for how to move forward and making good medical decisions, people probably do need to have a better recognition of what that disease means so that they can plan more appropriately.
And they can react also to your suggestions for therapy, probably in a more informed way.
And one of the nice things about the Seattle Heart Failure Model is that much of the prognosis is not only driven by patient characteristics, it's also driven by the therapies. So if patients go from being in heart failure with no good therapy to having heart failure with beta blockers, ACE inhibitors, spironolactone, implanted defibrillator, that their prognosis may markedly increase even twofold in terms of their life expectancy. And so not only can we help inform patients what a reasonable expectation for survival might be, but we can also show them using those kind of models that they can really change that prognosis if they're compliant with therapies. So we don't want to take their hope away, but we want to give them some data and some facts so that perhaps they can plan appropriately and also have some motivation to follow therapies that we think are helpful.
In that regard, when you talk with people who have an illness or their family members and they say that they're trying to keep a positive attitude because they think that will help them, one of the effects that you noticed was that the people who had the least amount of depression and who were the most optimistic about their survival were not, in fact, any more likely to survive than people who were mildly depressed or weren't so optimistic. Is that right?
That's right. Now, our study wasn't really powered to answer that question with great, refinement or detail. But we did not find any significant difference in patients who were, say, optimistic versus those who were pessimistic. Their survival curves over time were almost identical. There's been other study that's also shown the same thing in other disease processes. And I think that's something that's important to think about. I'd been reading some literature and some in the popular press recently about the concept of that we tell patients they need to be optimistic and fight their disease. And some of this was in relation to Edward Kennedy having a brain tumor. And there was some commentary that sometimes we give people unrealistic expectations. We tell them that they have to be optimistic and have to fight their disease to the bitter end. And in some ways, that may keep them positive and give them hope, but in other ways, that may give them unrealistic expectations. That if they do all this, they're going to make a difference in their disease process, and that may not be true.
Are there resources that you think would be helpful for listeners of this podcast to get hold of? And I will put them on the website.
Well, I think probably one of the most helpful for regular physicians who are taking care of patients with heart failure is actually to use the Seattle Heart Failure Model. It's available online, and Basically, it allows you to put in the variables that allow you to calculate what a patient's life expectancy would be. And it also has another feature in which different therapies can be added or subtracted, and a physician or a patient can then see how life expectancy is changed by those therapies. One of the easiest ways is to go to a navigation site like Google and just type in Seattle Heart Failure Model.
Okay.
And that's the first that comes up. But I will send you the link as well.
Okay, and I'll put it up in the transcript or in the website so that people will have access to it. Have I missed something here that that you wish we had discussed?
No, I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this. Obviously we feel that it's an important issue, and it certainly, I think warrants more research. One of my interests is that as patients' heart failure becomes worse, there is a time when patients go from needing just additional medications to actually requiring more advanced changes in their approach to their medical care and or very invasive therapies. They start to have to think about cardiac resynchronization or, more significantly, mechanical cardiac support devices such as an LVAD or cardiac transplantation. And those are huge decisions to make, and having a realistic outlook may be helpful in making appropriate decisions. The other is that if those kinds of options are not available or patients don't think they're appropriate, sometimes we have to think about hospice as well. And we know that hospice is underutilized in the heart failure community. So, again, we need to learn more about what these expectations mean to patients and how hope may relate to them. But ultimately, I think a greater knowledge of this area by physicians and patients will help us make better decisions in taking care of patients with advanced heart failure.
Well, this has been very interesting, Dr. Allen. Thanks so much for taking the time talking with us today.
Again, thanks, Joe, for having me. I appreciate it.
Finally this week, a puzzle for you from Joe Ilya's Archives of Internalized Medicine. The pieces are a boy takes a spill on his bicycle and a bottle of ink. A boy takes a spill on his bicycle and a bottle of ink. What's the clinical narrative? Phone in your answer to 617-440-4374. The winner will receive something that won't leak and ruin a perfectly good shirt or blouse. If you'd like to talk about something else, feel free. But leave your name and number so I can get back to you, not at you. That's 617-440-4374. Story links are available at podcasts.jwatch.org. For the Journal Watch podcast, I'm Joe Ilya.